the willows on the shore sweeping past, the only available gauge of our velocity, before we grab the paddles, settle deep into the boats, and go to work trying to keep our bows headed into the waves. Not that it makes much difference. The spray hits our faces and closes vision. The waves come aboard. In a moment we are soaking wet and spinning through the heart of the turmoil, bouncing off one rock and into the next. A great shining boulder looms before us, unavoidable. Ralph's boat slams upon it, and hangs there for a second or two until my boat, still roped to his, swings round in the spillway and pulls his free. Paddling furiously, we right the boats and face the next obstacle, skin past it safely, bounce in and out of a few more troughs, and suddenly find ourselves in the clear. The waves smooth off as the river broadens through a wider channel, resuming its serene and steady flow. We've run our first rapids and are still alive. The boats are drifting along, half full of water, and we are drenched, but the pipe in Ralph's teeth is still burning, so quickly did it all happen. Happy, exultant, we rest for a while in the loggy boats before bailing them out. If this is the worst Glen Canyon has to offer, we agree, give us more of the same. In a few minutes, the river obliges. A second group of rapids appears, wild as the first. Forewarned and overcautious this time, despite ourselves, we paddle too far out of the main current and end up aground in the shallows. We have to climb out of the boats and drag them over a pebble-covered bar until we again reach deep water. Hard work for game like Newcomb, but he makes no complaint. Back in the boats, sprawled out comfortably on our baggage, nothing lost but the road map, and there are no gas stations in Glen Canyon anyhow, we drift onward without further effort, paddles inboard and at rest. The surface of the river is wide and gleaming, slick as glass. An immaculate stillness pervades the canyon, pointed up deftly now and then by a gurgling eddy near the shore, the call of a bird. Smoking peacefully, we watch the golden light of afternoon climb the eastern wall as the sun goes down beyond the rim to the west. An early evening breeze rustles through the willows ashore, and we hear again the tinkling music of canyon wrens, like little silver bells falling across a glockenspiel. No, like wilderness lorelei, calling down to us from the rim rock, sweetest of all bird songs in the canyon country. Other voices also speak. Queer squawks and honkings from the thickets. Sounds we cannot identify until we see, a little later, a great blue heron flap its wings among the lavender plumes of a tamarisk tree. "Ralph Newcomb," I say, "do you believe in God?" "Who?" he says. "Who? Who?" "You said it," I say. An owl. Ravens. More canyon wrens. The splash of fish breaking the surface. Lizards palpitating on the rocks. And once we see, between us and the far shore, something sleek and dark following its nose upstream, a beaver. The same that lured the mountain men, Robidoux, Jim Bridger, Jedediah Smith, into these parts more than a century ago. The river bears us quietly along. The canyon fills with shadow and coolness. The sky above turns a deeper, darker blue as the last of the sunlight glows on the domes and turrets and elephant backs of the Navajo sandstone above the Wingate Cliffs. We begin to think about food and a camp for the night. When a beach of white sand comes in sight, backed with a stand of green young willows, we get out the paddles and work toward it, paddling strenuously across the current. As will usually happen, we are on the wrong side of the river when we want to make a landing. And it's a wide river this time of the year. And with Ralph on the upstream side of our double boat, I have to paddle twice as hard as he does just to keep even. Closing in on the beach, I jump out and wade ashore, towing the boats onto the sand. We tether them to a clump of willows, unload, and prepare to camp. My bedroll is a little wet, but everything else, well wrapped in tarpaulins, is dry, and our feelings of pleasure and satisfaction are as great as our appetite for supper. It is a beauteous evening, calm and free. We build a small fire of dead willow branches and propitiate the gods of river and canyon with the incense of wood smoke, an offering with which, being intangible beings, they are content. We, the worshippers of baser stuff, fry and eat the actual beans, corned beef, and eggs. A crude meal, no doubt, but the best of all sauces is hunger. To us it seems a shade better than anything available at Sardi's or Delmonico's. What's more, we aren't graveled for leg room. We make the coffee from river water, dipping a canful from among the rocks and letting it set for a time until the silt settles to the bottom. For entertainment, we have the murmur of the river, the drone of cicada and amphibians, the show of nighthawks plunging through the evening gulping bugs. Afterwards, we sit by the fire until the fire gives out, listening, smoking, analyzing socio-economic problems. "Look here, Newcomb," I say. "Do you think it's fitting that you and I should be here in the wilds, risking our lives amidst untold hardships, while our wives and loved ones lounge at their ease back in Albuquerque, enjoying the multifold comforts, benefits, and luxuries of modern contemporary 20th-century American urban civilization?" "Yes," he says. I rebuild the fire and drape my sleeping bag above it on a willow bough, smoking it good and proper. When it's ready, I scoop two shallow holes in the sand, one for the hip bones and one for the shoulder blades, lay out the sleeping bag and turn in. Ralph, peaceful as a hanging judge, is already sound asleep. For myself, I choose to listen to the river for a while, thinking river thoughts, before joining the night and the stars. Morning on the river. Up with the dawn, before the sun, Ralph still sleeping, strange invisible birds calling and croaking from the bush, I wash last night's dishes in the muddy river. And why not? That same force which corraded a gorge 5,000 feet deep through the Kaibab Plateau will also serve to scour the grease from the tin plates of the Abbey Newcomb expedition. The Colorado has no false pride. Then breakfast. Bacon and eggs, fried potatoes, coffee. The unknown birds continue to creak and chirrup. Some I begin to recognize. A mockingbird, killdeer, Mexican finches. Also the usual and prevalent canyon wrens and a few magpies and ravens. Ralph awakes, stirred to life by the aroma of food, takes a bath in the river, combs and pomades his hair, his long black evil sheepherder's beard. We eat. Afterwards, as we pack and load the boats, sun coming up over the rim, we begin to feel the familiar terrible desert thirst. We drink the last of the spring water in our canteens and, still thirsty, look to the river, that somber flow the color of burnt sienna, raw umber, muy Colorado, too thin to plow, as the Mormons say, and too thick to drink. But we drink it. We'll drink plenty of it before this voyage is over. The sun rises higher, fierce on our faces. The western wall blazes like hot iron. We shove off, keeping to the shady side of the canyon, and commence the second day of our journey. Why, we ask ourselves, floating onward in effortless peace deeper into Eden, why not go on like this forever? True, there are no women here, a blessing in disguise. No concert halls, no books, bars, galleries, theaters, or playing fields, no cathedrals of learning or high towers of finance, no wars, elections, traffic jams, or other amusements. None of the multifarious delights of what Ralph calls civilization. But, on the other hand, most anything else a man could desire is here in abundance. Catfish in the mainstream and venison in the side canyons, cottonwoods for shade and shelter, juniper for fuel, mossy springs, not always accessible, for thirst, and the ever-changing splendor of sky, cliffs, mesas, and river for the needs of the spirit. If necessary, we agree a man could live out his life in this place, once he had adjusted his nervous system to the awful quietude, the fearful tranquility. The silence, meaning here not the total absence of sound, for the river and its canyons are bright with a native music, but rather the total absence of confusion and clamor. That would be the problem. What Churchill spoke of as bloody peace, could we bear it for very long? Yet having known this, how could we ever return to the other? Newcomb, I say, you're condemned. You are doomed. So are you, he says. Let's drink to that. Where's that rum we were going to bring along? Stowed with the life jackets. And the case of beer we were going to tow instead of a dinghy? We drank it all back in Albuquerque. The thirst. I dip a can in the river under my elbow and place it on the gunwale, so to speak, of my little rubber boat, giving the mud in the water time to settle out. The river at this point is so steady and serene that the can of drinking water hardly trembles, though it's balanced on a rounded surface. The current carries us on its back smoothly, south and west, toward the Gulf of California, the Sea of Cortez, but with many a wonderful meander on the way. Occasionally we lay a paddle over the side, drop the blade in the water, and with the slightest, most infinitesimal of exertions, turn the double boat for a view in a different direction, saving ourselves the trouble, somewhat greater, of turning our heads or craning our necks. In this dreamlike voyage, any unnecessary effort seems foolish. Even vulgar, one might say. The river itself sets the tone. Utterly relaxed, completely at ease, it fulfills its mighty purpose without aim or effort. Only the slow swing of the canyon walls overhead and the illusory upstream flow of willows, tamarisk, and boulders on the shore reveal and indicate the sureness of our progress to the sea. We pass an opening in the eastern wall, the mouth of a tributary stream. Red Canyon Creek? There's no telling, and it certainly doesn't matter. No rapids here. Only a subtle roiling of the water, ripples corresponding to the ripples on the river's sandy bed. Beyond the side canyon, the walls rise up again, slick and monolithic, in color a blend of pink, buff, yellow, orange, overlaid in part with a glaze of desert varnish, iron oxide, or streaked in certain places with vertical draperies of black organic stains, the residue from plant life beyond the rim, and from the hanging gardens that flourish in the deep grottos high on the walls. Some of those alcoves are like great amphitheaters, large as the Hollywood Bowl, big enough for God's own symphony orchestra. When the sun stands noon high between the walls, we take our lunch, on board and under way, of raisins and oranges and beef jerky and the cool, cloudy river water with its rich content of iron and minerals, of radium, uranium, vanadium, and who knows what else. We have no fear of human pollution, for the nearest upstream town is Moab, population 5,000, 100 miles away. Blessed Utah! In any case, when a man must be afraid to drink freely from his country's rivers and streams, that country is no longer fit to live in. Time then to move on, to find another country, or, in the name of Jefferson, to make another country. The tree of liberty is nourished by the blood of tyrants. Or Bakunin, there are times when creation can be achieved only through destruction. The urge to destroy is then a creative urge. After lunch, we paddle hard across the current again to the west side of the river, seeking shade. Shade as precious as water. Without shade, in the middle of the river, we must cower beneath our hats, hammered by sun and by the reflected heat and blaze from the mirror-like sheen of the river, the hot red walls of the canyon. Once in the shade, we can rest, expand, unsquint our eyes, and see. All afternoon we glide onward, running a few slight rapids, slight compared to those of Cataract Canyon and Grand Canyon, smoking our tobacco, drinking the river, talking of anything and everything which comes to our heads, enjoying the delirium of bliss. Newcomb, for God's sake, where do we come from? Who knows? Where are we going? Who cares? Who? Who? Words fail. I draw the rusty harmonica from my shirt pocket and play old folk songs and little tunes from the big symphonies, a thin, sweet music that floats for a while like smoke in the vastness all around us, before fading into the silence, becoming forever a part of the wilderness. Yielding to nostalgia, I play the Sunday morning songs out of my boyhood. What a friend we have in Jesus, leaning, leaning, leaning on the everlasting arms. Diatonics for the soul. And we shall gather by the river, the beautiful, river. We shall gather by the river that flows from the throne of the Lord. We make our second river camp this evening on another sandy beach near the mouth of a small creek which enters the main canyon from the northwest. Hall's Creek? Bullfrog Creek? Sometimes I regret not having brought a decent map. Not far below are what look and sound like the most ferocious of rapids, far worse than those we'd encountered on the first day. But tomorrow we'll worry. We eat a good, simple, sandy supper of onion soup, beef and beans, tinned fruit and coffee. With the coffee we each have a pipeful of Newcomb's mixture, half Bull Durham and half Prince Albert. The first for flavor and the second for bulk. Good, cheap, working man's tobacco. After the meal, while Ralph washes the dishes, I take the canteens and walk up the creek to get some spring water, if possible. In the sand, I see the prints of deer and coyote and bobcat, also a few cattle tracks, strays perhaps, fairly fresh. I find no spring within a reasonable distance and return to camp with empty canteens. There is water in the creek, of course, but we'd rather drink from the river than downstream from a Hereford cow. Dark when I return, with only the light of Ralph's fire to guide me. As I brush away sticks and stones on the ground, making a place for my sleeping bag, I see a scorpion scuttle off, tail up and stinger ready. Newcomb and I meditate upon the red coals of the fire before turning in. Watching the sky, I see shooting stars. Blue-green and vivid, course across the narrow band of sky between the canyon walls. From downriver, as I fall asleep, comes the deep, dull roar of the rapids, a sound which haunts the background of my dreams all night long. We get up too late in the morning and have to cook breakfast in the awful heat of the sun. I burn the bacon, and the wind blows sand in the pancake batter. But we're getting accustomed to sand. Sand in our food and drink, in our teeth and eyes and whiskers, in our bedrolls and underwear. Sand becomes a part of our existence, which, like breathing, we take for granted. Boats loaded, we launch them into the river, still roped together side by side for the sake of comfort, conversation, and safety. The rapids that worried my dreams turn out in daylight to be little more than a stretch of choppy waves and a few eroded boulders, past which our boats slip without difficulty. If it were not so late in June, following a dry winter, the river consequently lower than usual, we would probably not notice these trivial ripples at all. Down the river we drift in a kind of waking dream, gliding beneath the great curving cliffs with their tapestries of water stains, the golden alcoves, the hanging gardens, the seeps, the springs where no man will ever drink, the royal arches in high relief, and the amphitheaters shaped like seashells. A sculptured landscape mostly bare of vegetation. Earth in the nude. We try the walls for echo values. Hello, hello, hello. And the sounds that come back to us, far off and fading, are so strange and lovely, transmuted by distance, that we fall into silence enchanted. We pass sandbars where stands of white-plumed cane, and the lacy blossoms of young tamarisk wave in the breeze among driftwood logs aged to a silver finish by sun and wind and water. In the lateral canyons we sometimes see thickets of gamble oak and occasional cottonwoods with gray elephantine trunks and bright, clear green leaves, delicately suspended, trembling in the air. We pass too many of these marvelous side canyons, to my everlasting regret, for most of them will never again be wholly accessible to human eyes or feet. Their living marvels must remain forever unknown, to be drowned beneath the dead water of the coming reservoir, buried for centuries under mud. Here we become aware of the chief disadvantage of our cheap little rubber boats. Far too often, when we see some place that demands unhurried exploration, the strong current will carry us past before we can paddle our awkward craft to the shore. You might think we could make a landing anyway and walk back upriver on the bank, but in Glen Canyon, where the sandstone walls often rise straight up out of the water, this is sometimes impossible. Furthermore, we are lazy, indolent animals, Newcomb and I, half mesmerized by the idyllic ease of our voyage. Neither of us can seriously believe that very soon the beauty we are passing through will be lost. Instinctively, we expect a miracle. The dam will never be completed. They'll run out of cement or slide rules. The engineers will all be shipped to Upper Volta. Or if these fail, some unknown hero with a rucksack full of dynamite strapped to his back will descend into the bowels of the dam. There he will hide his high explosives, where they'll do the most good, attach blasting caps to the lot, and with angelic ingenuity link the caps to the official dam wiring system in such a way that when the time comes for the grand opening ceremony, when the President and the Secretary of the Interior and the governors of the Four Corner States are all in full regalia assembled, the button which the President pushes will ignite the loveliest explosion ever seen by man, reducing the great dam to a heap of rubble in the path of the river. The splendid new rapids thus created we will name Floyd E. Dominey Falls, in honor of the chief of the Reclamation Bureau. A more suitable memorial could hardly be devised for such an esteemed and loyal public servant. Idle, foolish, futile daydreams. While we dream and drift on the magic river, the busy little men with their gargantuan appliances are hard at work, day and night, racing against the time when the people of America might possibly awake to discover something precious and irreplaceable about to be destroyed. Nature's polluted. There's man in every secret corner of her, doing damned wicked deeds. The ravens mock us as we float by. Unidentifiable birds call to us from the dark depths of the willow thickets. Solitary calls from the wild. We see a second beaver, again like the first, swimming upstream. All of our furred and feathered and hairy-hided cousins who depend for their existence upon the river and the lower canyons, the deer, the beaver, the coyotes, the wildcats and cougars, most of the birds and smaller animals, will soon be compelled to find new homes, if they can. For there is no land in the canyon country not already fully occupied to the limit of the range by their own kind. There are no vacant lots in nature. At 4 or 5 miles per hour, much too fast, we glide on through the golden light, the heat, the crystalline quiet. At times, almost beneath us, the river stirs with sudden odd uproars, as the silty bed below alters in its conformations. Then, comfortably readjusted, the river flows on, and the only noise, aside from that of scattered birds, is the ripple of the water, the gurgling eddies off the sand spits, the sound of Newcomb puffing on his old pipe. We are deep in the wild now. Deep in the lonely, sweet, remote, primeval world, far, far from anywhere familiar to men and women. The nearest town from where we are would be Blanding in southeast Utah, close to the Colorado line, or maybe Hanksville in south-central Utah, north of the Henry Mountains. Either place about 100 miles away by foot, and both on the far side of an uninhabited wilderness of canyons, mesas, clay hills, slick rock domes, sand flats, pinon and juniper forests. Wilderness. The word itself is music. Wilderness. Wilderness. We scarcely know what we mean by the term, though the sound of it draws all whose nerves and emotions have not yet been irreparably stunned, deadened, numbed by the caterwauling of commerce, the sweating scramble for profit and domination. Why such allure in the very word? What does it really mean? Can wilderness be defined in the words of government officialdom as simply a minimum of not less than 5,000 contiguous acres of roadless area? This much may be essential in attempting a definition, but it is not sufficient. Something more is involved. Suppose we say that wilderness invokes nostalgia, a justified, not merely sentimental nostalgia for the lost America our forefathers knew. The word suggests the past and the unknown, the womb of earth from which we all emerged. It means something lost and something still present, something remote and at the same time intimate, something buried in our blood and nerves, something beyond us and without limit. Romance, but not to be dismissed on that account. The romantic view, while not the whole of truth, is a necessary part of the whole truth. But the love of wilderness is more than a hunger for what is always beyond reach. It is also an expression of loyalty to the earth which bore us and sustains us, the only home we shall ever know, the only paradise we ever need, if only we had the eyes to see. Original sin, the true original sin, is the blind destruction for the sake of greed of this natural paradise which lies all around us, if only we were worthy of it. Now, when I write of paradise, I mean paradise, not the banal heaven of the saints. When I write paradise, I mean not only apple trees and golden women, but also scorpions and tarantulas and flies, rattlesnakes and Gila monsters, sandstorms, volcanoes and earthquakes, bacteria and bear, cactus, yucca, bladderweed, ocotillo and mesquite, flash floods and quicksand, and, yes, disease and death and the rotting of the flesh. Paradise is not a garden of bliss and changeless perfection where the lions lie down like lambs. What would they eat? And the angels and cherubim and seraphim rotate in endless idiotic circles like clockwork about an equally inane and ludicrous, however roseate, unmoved mover. Play safe. Worship only in clockwise direction. Let's all have fun together. That particular painted fantasy of a realm beyond time and space, which Aristotle and the Church Fathers tried to palm off on us, has met, in modern times, only neglect and indifference, passing on into the oblivion it so richly deserved. While the paradise of which I write and wish to praise is with us yet, the here and now, the actual, tangible, dogmatically real earth on which we stand. Some people who think of themselves as hard-headed realists would tell us that the cult of the wild is possible only in an atmosphere of comfort and safety, and was therefore unknown to the pioneers who subdued half a continent with their guns and plows and barbed wire. Is this true? Consider the sentiments of Charles Marion Russell, the cowboy artist, as quoted in John Hutchins' One Man's Montana. I have been called a pioneer. In my book, a pioneer is a man who comes to virgin country, traps off all the fur, kills off all the wild meat, cuts down all the trees, grazes off all the grass, plows the roots up, and strings 10 million miles of wire. A pioneer destroys things and calls it civilization. Others who endured hardships and privations no less severe than those of the frontiersmen were John Muir, H.D. Thoreau, John James Audubon, and the painter George Catlin, all of whom wandered on foot over much of our country and found in it something more than merely raw material for pecuniary exploitation. A sixth example, and my favorite, is, of course, Major J. Wesley Powell, one-armed veteran of the Civil War, sitting in a chair lashed to the deck of the small wooden boat with which he led his brave party into the unknown canyons of the Green, Grand, and Colorado Rivers. From the railroad town of Green River, Wyoming, to the mouth of the Grand Canyon, in what is now Lake Mead, Powell's first journey took 3 months. Within that time, he and his men withstood a variety of unpleasant experiences, including the loss of a boat, the hard toil of lowering their boats by rope down the worst of the rapids, moldy flour and shortages of meat, extremes of heat and cold, illness, and the constant fear of the unknown, the uncertainty of success, the ever-present possibility that around the next bend of the canyon they might encounter hazards worse than any they had so far overcome. This psychological pressure eventually proved too much for three of Powell's men. Near the end of the voyage, these three left the expedition and tried to make their way overland back to civilization, and were all killed by Indians. Powell knew the inner gorge of the Grand Canyon as a terrible and gloomy underworld, scene of much physical and mental suffering for himself and his men, but despite this and despite all that had happened in his explorations, he would write of the canyon as a whole in a panegyric accent. The glories and the beauties of form, color, and sound unite in the Grand Canyon. Forms unrivaled even by the mountains, colors that vie with sunsets, and sounds that span the diapason from tempest to tinkling raindrop, from cataract to bubbling fountain. You cannot see the Grand Canyon in one view, as if it were a changeless spectacle from which a curtain might be lifted. But to see it, you have to toil from month to month through its labyrinths. It is a region more difficult to traverse than the Alps or the Himalayas, but if strength and courage are sufficient for the task, by a year's toil a concept of sublimity can be obtained never again to be equaled on the hither side of paradise. No. Wilderness is not a luxury but a necessity of the human spirit, and as vital to our lives as water and good bread. A civilization which destroys what little remains of the wild, the spare, the original, is cutting itself off from its origins and betraying the principle of civilization itself. If industrial man continues to multiply his numbers and expand his operations, he will succeed in his apparent intention to seal himself off from the natural and isolate himself within a synthetic prison of his own making. He will make himself an exile from the earth, and then will know at last, if he is still capable of feeling anything, the pain and agony of final loss. He will understand what the captive Zia Indians meant when they made a song out of their sickness for home. My home over there, now I remember it, and when I see that mountain far away, why then I weep, remembering my home. Down the river. Our boats turn slowly in the drift. We see through a break in the canyon walls a part of the Henry Mountains retreating to the northwest. Last range in the United States to be named and explored and mapped. Mount Ellsworth, one of the lower peaks, is the one we see, rising sharp and craggy against the sky, a laccolithic dome of varicolored sedimentary and igneous rock, part of the intrusion now exposed by erosion, furred over with a growth of pinon pine, juniper, and jack pine at the highest elevations. The flowers we cannot see but easily imagine will also be blooming up there in the cool. Larkspur, lupin, Indian paintbrush, the seagull lily, perhaps a few columbines. The boats continue to turn, and facing downriver, now we see to the southwest, far beyond the opening in the cliffs, a kind of convulsed hump in the earth's stony crust. It is the southern end of the Water Pocket Fold, a 50-mile-long monocline or ridge of warped sandstone, eroded along its base into triangular studs of naked rock that look from here like the teeth of a mowing machine. This will be our only glimpse of a weird area that is sure to be someday another national park, complete with police, administrators, paved highways, automobile nature trails, official scenic viewpoints, designated campgrounds, laundromats, cafeterias, coke machines, flush toilets, and admission fees. If you wish to see it as it should be seen, don't wait. There's little time. How do you get there? Well, I couldn't tell you. A little after noon, when the surface of the river is gleaming under the sun like molten amber, we see an abandoned mining camp ahead of us on the eastern shore. We paddle hard to port and beach our craft on a steep and slippery mud bank, tethering it to a stout willow tree. While Ralph makes himself comfortable in the shade, happy to take a siesta, he is one of those fortunates who can sleep at will or stay up talking and drinking till dawn, like Socrates if he prefers, I go on up beyond the vegetated shore to the ledge of barren red rock on which the camp is situated. Here I find the familiar, fascinating, semi-melancholy debris of free enterprise. Rusted tin cans, a roofless frame shack, the rags of tents and broken canvas cots, rusty shovels, a blunted old iron bullprick, rotting rat-bitten steel-toed boots, dynamite boxes, battered hard hats, two sticks of blasting powder, but no caps, sheaves of legal documents pertaining to mining claims and production agreements, rather interesting reading, a couple of withered sun-bleached topographical maps, and an astonishing heap of tattered magazines of the all-man he-male type. True, false, male, a little queer, stag, full of ragged does blasting Japs with machine guns, saga, fairy tales, real, quite phony, and others of the genre, all of them badly chewed up by rodents, barely readable, with the best pictures torn out by some scoundrel. These fellows must have spent a lot of time reading. No wonder they failed to find whatever they'd been looking for. Gold? God? Uranium? And had to leave. I climb the hill behind this ghost camp, up mountainous dunes of copper-colored sand, and find the trace of a jeep trail winding off to the east into a never-never land of black buttes, salt domes, and prehistoric plateaus inhabited only by mule deer and mountain lions. Perhaps this track leads to the mine. There are no diggings of any kind in the vicinity of the camp. The prospectors or miners had no doubt established their camp near the river so they'd have a reliable water supply. Everything else they needed, from boots to beans, perhaps even the jeep, must have been brought in by way of the river, for this camp is a long, long way from any road known to the mapmakers. The climb gives me some comprehension of the fact that we are down inside the mantle of the earth. For though I stand on the summit of a considerable hill, at least 1,000 feet above the river, I can see no more than 10 miles in any direction. On all points the view is cut off, near or far, by the unscalable walls of buttes, mesas, and plateaus far higher than the hill beneath my feet. They are ranged in bench or terrace fashion, up from the river, forming an almost horizontal skyline all around me which obstructs any sight of the mountains that I know are out there. The Henry Mountains to the northwest, the LaSalle Mountains to the northeast, the Blue Mountains to the east, Navajo Mountain somewhere on the south, and Kaiparowitz on the west or southwest. In all of this vast well of space enclosed by mesa and plateau, a great irregular arena of right angles and sheer rock in which the entire population and all the works of Manhattan, say, could easily be hidden, there is no sign whatever, anywhere, of human or animal life. Nothing. Not even a soaring buzzard. In the heat and stillness, nothing moves, nothing stirs. The silence is complete. It is a strange fact that in the canyon country, the closer you get to the river, which is the living artery of the entire area, the drier, more barren, less habitable the land becomes. In this respect, the desert of the Colorado is opposite to that of the Nile in Egypt or the Rio Grande in New Mexico, where, in both cases, life, men, and the cities are gathered along the shores of the rivers. Along the Colorado River, there is no town from Moab in Utah to Needles in California, a distance of over 1,000 miles, if we accept the two small improvised, completely artificial company towns connected with the building and operation of Glen Canyon Dam and Boulder Dam. What is true of human life is true also of plant life. Except for the comparatively lush growth along the very banks of the river and the floors of the many narrow side canyons, life in all forms diminishes in quantity as you approach the Colorado. The mountains are covered with forest, the plateaus are also forested. At the higher elevations with aspen and yellow pine and farther down with pinon and juniper. But as you descend through the lateral canyons toward the great river, the pinon and juniper yield to sagebrush and other shrubs, from that to yucca, prickly pear, and ephedra, and from that, nearing the river, to almost nothing but scattered clumps of saltbush and blackbrush and the fragile annuals, snakeweed, mule-ear sunflowers, and other widely dispersed rain-dependent growths, separated from each other by open spaces of nothing but sand and rock. The reason for this apparent anomaly is twofold. First, though all of the plateau and canyon province must be classified as an arid or semi-arid region, the higher tablelands naturally receive a little more rainfall on the average than the lower areas. Second, the Colorado River carries its great volume of water swiftly seaward well below the general level of the surrounding land, through deep and largely impassable gorges, such as the Grand Canyon, and therefore does not and cannot water the desert through which it passes. Not until the river reaches the open country beyond the canyons is its water utilizable for agriculture, and there, as we know, California and Arizona and Mexico have been fighting each other for half a century over the division of the precious liquid. Each additional dam that is built on the Colorado, incidentally, reduces the quantity of usable water, because of unavoidable losses through evaporation and percolation into the porous sandstone containing the reservoirs. The sun is beginning to give me a headache. I glissade down the slopes of sand, copper-gold and coral-pink, past isolated clusters of sunflowers, scarlet penstemon and purple asters, to the shade of the willows and the life of the river. Here I take a swim and drink my fill of the cool, muddy water. Both at the same time. We eat lunch, Ralph and I, and lie for another hour or two in the willow glade until the bright inferno in the sky has edged far enough westward to let the cliffs shade part of the river. Then we launch off in the middle of the afternoon and paddle across the current to the shady side, abandoning ourselves once more to the noiseless, effortless, powerful slide of the Colorado through its burnished chute of stone. Although we are voyaging blind and ignorant, without map or compass or guide, I know, from Powell's book and hearsay, that sometime soon we should reach the mouth of the Escalante River, another small tributary. This I wish to explore, for I have heard that back in its meandering depths are natural bridges and arches, cliff dwellings and hanging gardens and other spontaneous marvels. As the sun goes down, and we drift on through the smoky blue twilight and the bird calls, I keep the Escalante in mind, one eye skinned for the likely debouchement. Reluctantly, I allow to pass the intriguing slits and dark, deep defiles which promise much, but seem improbable. Then we see not far ahead and on the correct starboard shore the opening of a big canyon, full of shadows and cottonwoods. I feel at once with a thrill of certainty that here is one we must not pass. We head for shore. But already the current is pulling us to the middle of the river, and everything is farther away than it looks. We work desperately toward the riverside and the mouth of the big side canyon, but we've started too late. The river sweeps us by, and we're going to miss it. This has happened to us several times before, and each time, spoiled by the wonders still lying ahead, we have surrendered to the river, given up and floated on. This time, however, we resolve not to give up. We keep paddling till we hit the shore, and then work our way upstream along the bank, with the aid of the willows at the water's edge. We reach an eddy and backwater, paddle around a giant boulder, and find ourselves at last safe in the quiet, warm, green floodwater of the canyon's entrance. Nearly exhausted, we rest for a while in the boats before paddling slowly into the dark canyon. The sun has been down for an hour. The moon will not clear the rim rock for another hour. The great canyon we have entered is as dark as a cave. We move deeper inside until we see in the dimness what looks like a white beach attached precariously to the foot of a sheer wall. We make for it, land, secure the boats, find a little dead wood, and start a fire. The heat in this deep and narrow canyon seems dense, stifling, almost sickening after a day on the wide and breezy expanse of the river. We make tea, but have no appetite for any supper but a tin of fruit each. After the necessary soporific smoke and a weary conversation, we unroll our sleeping bags and go to bed. I sleep uneasily, haunted by the persistent dream of rising water and the drifting away of our boats. Near midnight, the waxing half-moon overhead, I wake up to the noise of wind and splashing water. The water is lapping at the sand less than a foot from my sleeping bag. I roll out of the bag, make sure the boats are still securely tied to the willows, and am about to wake up Ralph. Hesitating, I realize that the cause of the high water is not what I'd been half-consciously fearing all along, a flash flood from the world above us, but simply a strong wind blowing waves into the canyon from the river. The wind has freshened the air and cooled it. Naked in the moonlight, I enjoy the change, and listen for a time to the hoodoo voice of a great horned owl up on the rim somewhere. Then I go back to sleep, and this time sleep well, lullabied by wind and water. In the morning, before breakfast, we dump our gear loosely into the boats and paddle on up the canyon until we reach shallow water. We are now around a bend and out of sight of the river. Here I get out and tow the boats farther through the still backwaters, wading on till we come to the place where a broad, shallow stream of clear water enters and merges with the dead water of the flood. This stream is about 6 inches deep and 6 feet wide, with a fast, steady flow. Undoubtedly the Escalante River. The water is fresh and clean, almost cool. Without bothering this time to look for cattle tracks, we each take a long and satisfying drink. Feeling much better now, our appetites returning, we make breakfast, eating the last of our bacon, the last of the eggs, and the last of the canned fruit. From now on, we must subsist on our dehydrated food supplies, survival rations, or on whatever we can forage from the land. As I prepare for a day's hike up the Escalante, I can hear Ralph muttering something about channel cat. I pay no attention. Bouillon cubes and raisins are good enough for me, so long as they are seasoned with plenty of sun and storm and adventure. But Newcomb, somewhat of a gourmet, has different ideas. Lacing my boots, I see him attach a fragment of moldy salami to a fish hook and toss it, with a line, of course, into the deep and muddy water below the stream. "You got a license, bud?" I demand. For reply, he clenches his right hand, extends the middle finger rigidly, and thrusts it heavenward. Invoking the deity? I take off, but before I'm out of earshot, I hear a curious thumping noise. I look back, and there's Newcomb, beating a giant catfish on the head with his canoe paddle, putting it quickly out of its misery. God provides. What little I can see of the sky between the high and almost interlocking walls of the canyon looks cloudy, promising rain. Rain or sun, it's all one to me. Burdened only with canteen, a stick, and a lunch of raisins and chipped beef, I march up the firm wet sand of the canyon floor, reading the register. Many deer, one coyote, the three-toed track of a big bird, many killdeer or sandpipers, many lizards, the winding trail of a snake, no cattle, no horses, no people. All of the prints look fresh, none more than a few days old. With good reason. The damp sand, the wet rushes crushed riverward under a layer of silt, the dust-free polish of pebbles and stones, the general appearance of neatness and tidiness all indicate that the canyon has quite recently been flushed out with a vigorous torrent. I look at the perpendicular walls rising slick and unbroken on both sides. In case a flood should now appear, what could I do? Nothing. I'd float with the tide back to Newcomb and the boats, eat catfish for lunch. The walk gets wet. The channel of the stream meanders from one wall to the opposite, and within the first mile I have to wade it a dozen times. Hard on boots. Impossible to outflank these meanders, for they swing hard against and undercut the cliff, first on one side and then the other. Should have brought tennis shoes. Since I have no tennis shoes, I take off the boots and sling them over my shoulder, proceeding barefoot. I walk lightly across shoals of quicksand and ford the river when necessary, but over the pebbled and rocky stretches, the going is hard and slow. Another half mile and I come to a dripping spring. This is a seep, high on the canyon wall, 200 feet above my head, where groundwater breaks out between beds of sandstone and slides over the contours of the cliff, nourishing the typical delicate greenery of moss, fern, columbine, and monkey flower. Below the garden, the cliff curves deeply inward, forming an overhang that would shelter a house. At this point, the water is released from the draw of surface tension and falls free through the air in a misty, wavy spray down to the canyon floor where I stand, as in a fine shower, filling my canteen and soaking myself and drinking all at the same time. I go on. The clouds have disappeared. The sun is still beyond the rim. Under a wine-dark sky, I walk through light reflected and re-reflected from the walls and floor of the canyon, a radiant golden light that glows on rock and stream, sand and leaf, in varied hues of amber, honey, whiskey. The light that never was is here now, in the storm-sculptured gorge of the Escalante. That crystal water flows toward me in shimmering S-curves, looping quietly over shining pebbles, buff-colored stone, and the long, sleek bars and reefs of rich red sand, in which glitter grains of mica and pyrite, fool's gold. The canyon twists and turns, serpentine as its stream, and with each turn comes a dramatic and novel view of tapestried walls 500, 1,000 feet high, of silvery driftwood wedged between boulders, of mysterious and inviting sub-canyons to the side, within which I can see living stands of grass, cane, salt cedar, and sometimes the delicious magical green of a young cottonwood, with its 10,000 exquisite leaves vibrating like spangles in the vivid air. The only sound is the whisper of the running water, the touch of my bare feet on the sand, and once or twice, out of the stillness, the clear song of a canyon wren. Is this at last the locust day? There are enough cathedrals and temples and altars here for a Hindu pantheon of divinities. Each time I look up one of the secretive little side canyons, I half expect to see not only the cottonwood tree rising over its tiny spring, the leafy god, the desert's liquid eye, but also a rainbow-colored corona of blazing light, pure spirit, pure being, pure disembodied intelligence, about to speak my name. If a man's imagination were not so weak, so easily tired, if his capacity for wonder not so limited, he would abandon forever such fantasies of the supernal. He would learn to perceive in water, leaves, and silence more than sufficient of the absolute and marvelous, more than enough to console him for the loss of the ancient dreams. Walking up the Escalante is like penetrating a surrealist corridor in a Tamayo dream. All is curved and rounded. The course of the mainstream in canyon, as indirect as a sidewinder, winding upon itself like the intestines of a giant. The canyon floor averages about 50 feet in width, but the curving walls are at least 5 times that high, without benches or ledges, sheer, monolithic, and smooth as if carved in butter, paralleling each other in a sort of loosely jointed ball-and-socket fashion, each concavity matched by a corresponding convexity on the opposite wall. And all this inspired by the little stream that swings through the rock and the centuries, truly a perfect example of what geologists call an entrenched meander. Others have been here before. On a mural wall I find petroglyphs, the images of bighorn sheep, snakes, mule deer, sun and rain cloud symbols, men with lances, the old people, the Anasazi. I come to a second dripping spring, water seeping from a fissure far above, falling in spray upon a massive slab of rock at the foot of the wall. On the flat surface of this tilted slab, somebody, maybe a Mormon cowboy 50 years ago, maybe an Indian 800 years ago, has chiseled 2 converging grooves which catch some of the falling water and conduct it to a carved spout at the lower edge. The grooves are well worn, smooth as a pebble to the touch. As I sit there drinking water from cupped hands, I happen to look up and see on the opposite wall 100 feet above the floor of the canyon, the ruins of 3 tiny stone houses in a shallow cave. As is the case with many cliff dwellings, the erosion of 8 centuries has removed whole blocks of rock which formerly must have supported ladders and handholds, making the ghost village now inaccessible. I am content, however, to view the remains from below. Neither a souvenir collector nor an archaeologist, I have no desire to stir the ancient dust for the sake of removing from their setting a few potsherds, a few corn cobs, a child's straw sandal, an arrow point, perhaps a broken skull. What interests me is the quality of that pre-Columbian life, the feel of it, the atmosphere. We know enough of the homely details, the cultivation of maize, beans, melons, the hunting of rabbit and deer, the manufacture of pottery, baskets, ornaments of coral and bone, the construction of the fort-like homes, for apparently, like some 20th-century Americans, the Anasazi lived under a cloud of fear. Fear. Is that the key to their lives? What persistent and devilish enemies they must have had, or thought they had, when even here in the intricate heart of a desert labyrinth 100 foot-miles from the nearest grassland, forest, and mountains, they felt constrained to make their homes as swallows do, in niches high on the face of a cliff. Their manner of life was constricted, conservative, cautious. Perhaps only the pervading fear could keep such a community together. Where all think alike, there is little danger of innovation. Every child in this quiet place would have learned, along with his language and games, the legends of old battles and massacres, flights and migrations. He would be taught that the danger of attack was always present, that in any hour of the day or night, from up or down the canyon or over the rim, the enemy might appear, cruel, devious, hungry, terrible, perhaps in the shape of those red-horned, hollow-eyed, wide-shouldered monsters painted on the walls of Sego Canyon north of Moab. Long ago, the cliff dwellings were abandoned. Were the inhabitants actually destroyed by the enemies they had always dreaded? Or were they reduced and driven out by disease, by something as undramatic as bad sanitation, pollution of their water and air? Or could it have been, finally, simply their own fears which poisoned their lives beyond hope of recovery and drove them into exile and extinction? As I